morning. Hopefully I've got the nappy crowd, you know, here in the post-lunch time slot. I was kind of hoping that Brian Bracewell was going to have some sausage for us at lunchtime, because I was kind of use it as an intro to my comments about cotton pickers in the meat market. I know a bunch of you went on the Texas tour this year, and and so you're familiar with the concept that in Texas we call barbecue. We call sausage barbecue, which I know is not a popular concept in other parts of the South. But the question comes up, how did sausage come to be called barbecue? And the answer, the easy answer is, it was the cotton pickers who made that decision. And a snapshot of that little cultural collision between the cotton pickers and the German and Czech butchers who founded the meat markets is kind of become the central myth and the core of Texas barbecue. And it's at once fascinating, and it's also given rise to a lot of misconceptions and a lot of debate. So I want to talk about that cultural collision, first of all. But before that, let me get to my disclaimers. I am not a real Texan, although I'm often played one on TV. I came to Texas when I was 17. I graduated from the University of Texas. Three generations of my family live there now. Three of my brothers, my children were born there. But I spent 23 years there now. But I was not born in Texas. So I want to be clear about that. I don't speak for native Texans. I'm an adopted Texan. The other thing I want to talk about is how I sort of came upon this subject. And as I was researching the book Legends of Texas Barbecue, which many of you have seen, I started out with the same understanding that everybody else that I knew who wrote about Texas barbecue had, which was that the meat market was the beginning of it. And, you know, there are parts of that that don't make a lot of sense. Like, how did these German and Czech butchers suddenly become barbecue experts? I mean, what they were cooking, in essence, was German smoked meat. It was, you know, smoked pork loin, which Kaiser Rippchen, I believe they call that, and smoked sausages that are typical in Germany and Czechoslovakia. So, you know, all of a sudden, this is the quintessence of Texas barbecue. Well, you know, how did that happen? And who says that that's barbecue? And the answer is that the greatest barbecue experts ever said that that was barbecue, and that was the cotton pickers. The cotton pickers, To take a sort of a snapshot in time, let's take around about 1890. You've got a lot of Germans who've migrated to Texas, and in the Cotton Belt, the Blacklands Prairie, very fertile land in central Texas, right up to the Balcones Escarpment, where the Hill Country starts. You've got cotton towns. And in these cotton towns, you've got mainly German population, and you've got a meat market in every one of these towns. They're producing the same meats they produce back home, and the residents are taking these smoked pork and sausages, and they're eating them at home with sauerkraut and red cabbage, the same stuff that, you know, German folks have been eating smoked meat with for a long time. But after slavery ended, there wasn't anyone to pick the cotton except for recruited itinerant farm workers. And the first itinerant farm workers were blacks, freed slaves and their progeny. And they, of course, if they knew anything, they knew how to pick cotton. And they knew the traditions of cotton farming. And as they went around to these towns, the numbers are hard to even imagine. But basically the cotton pickers equaled the population of most of the towns where they went. There was just an army of them. And feeding them was a big project. They didn't eat in restaurants. They ate what they could find in stores. And of course, after a long day of, you know, picking cotton in the hot sun, smoked meat was, you know, one of the best things they could find in the stores of these small towns. And so they descended on these German meat markets, and what they found were smoked meats. And in their vocabulary, that was barbecue. And so that's how what was German smoked meat came to be perceived by this other culture as barbecue. Over time, of course, the German and Czech butchers realized that they had a bonanza on their hands because there was a whole lot of cotton pickers and they ate a whole lot of meat. So for the roughly 6-week cotton harvest season, which rotated from the very south of Texas up to Lubbock, you know, from what the time period was, they would build enormous extra smokers and they would smoke just huge amounts of meat. I did some oral histories with some, you know, pit bosses whose families went way back. Bill Smolik in Cuero told me that his father opened his meat market in Carnes City, Texas in 1918. And he said his job was to sit under the counter and count the money. And one Saturday in, it must have been, you know, 1920s, rough, you know, shortly after the place opened, they did $1,000 in one Saturday selling smoked meat at 50 cents a pound. So that's a ton of meat that they did. It turned into a big business. And the people who helped make it a big business were the same blacks and Hispanics. They were the people who were tending the pits and who were hired to work in the barbecue. And one assumes there was some transfer of knowledge that, you know, these places went from being German meat markets. Through the help of the people, the audience itself, they learned the older traditions of Texas barbecue. But I didn't know all that when I started writing this book. I just knew about the stories of the meat markets. And in fact, those stories are pretty much the dogma of Texas barbecue today. In Texas Monthly, in May 1997, there was an article called Smokin', which was a survey of the best barbecue in the state, written by several of the state's best regarded food writers. And in that story, the following quote appears. "The ultimate roots of barbecue can be traced back to the Stone Age. Its more immediate Texas origins date from 100 or so years ago, when meat markets cooked and smoked their surplus stock, selling the finished product to customers." So, you know, that's the orthodoxy. That's what everybody knows. And that is what we read again and again and again in the writings of food writers who come from outside of Texas to explore Texas barbecue. They tell us, you know, sort of what we all already know, that these meat markets invented Texas barbecue. Well, what's wrong with that? Well, for one thing, everybody who comes to Texas to do a survey of Texas barbecue comes away with a list of white-owned barbecue places. So, for one thing, the cotton pickers, since the picking of cotton has been mechanized since the 1960s anyway, there are no more cotton pickers. And so all that's left are the meat markets. So we're left with this picture of Germans and Czechs inventing this Texas barbecue style, absent the blacks and Hispanics, who are really the people who made these businesses. So it's a skewed picture that, you know, that we've started to see. And when I did the Legends of Texas Barbecue, I went around the state to various archives and museums and universities and asked for, you know, old writings and photos of barbecue. And I ran across a lot of photos like this one of, here they're barbecuing 42 cattle in open pits. And obviously the pit masters are black. They're turning the meat with pitchforks and they're mopping it with cotton mops. So these pictures, you know, obviously tell you, here's one with whole animals stretched over coals. These pictures tell you that obviously the meat markets didn't start Texas barbecue, that there was something there a long time ago. I also, looking back through the slave narratives, interviews with former slaves, which were tried to record the history of the Civil War period, I ran across several mentions of barbecue in Texas by former slaves. Here's a couple. I worked at Pilot Knob in Tennessee just before I come to Waco. Lots of people come to Texas from there. Mongs, these was Mars buried trice. The servants had lots of picnics, and old Mars would give us meat for the barbecue. Here's an interview with a slave, former slave named Anderson Jones, a WPA writer did in 1938, where he talked about the June 19th celebration, June 19th being the day when the slaves were freed in Texas, June 19th, 1865. I can remember when I was just a boy about 9 years old when freedom comes, when we commence to have the 19th celebrations, and everybody seems like white and black, come and get some barbecue. So the reality is that there was a black tradition for barbecue in Texas, and somehow it was lost. And I tried to include as much as I could find about black and Hispanic barbecue in my book. But of course, I told the meat market story and the story of the Czech and German barbecuers as well. One of the reviews I got in my book, John Thorne, who's I very much respect and I've been a correspondent with for many years, really faulted my book for not having more blacks and Hispanics in it, particularly blacks, because in his view, barbecue is an undisputedly African-American tradition. And as Charlie Vergos from The Rendezvous said in that movie last night, he's the first one to admit as a white guy that this is a tradition we've borrowed from African Americans and which, the whites have made more from than the blacks have, as he put it. In the case of the meat market, that relationship is goes a little deeper because there's a place called Charlie's General Store in Egypt, Texas, where the center of the plantation is this country store. There's a saloon, the store where meat is barbecued and cokes are sold. The cotton pickers had to line up to get paid at the paymaster right next to the station where the barbecue was being sliced. So, the plantation owner put the money in their hands, and put the barbecue sandwiches out, in the same moment. The same story is seen again and again. Kreitz Market, which is the original location of Kreitz Market, which was the most famous of the Texas barbecue places in most people's opinion, is located directly across the street from the cotton gin in Lockhart, one of the biggest cotton shipping points, in the area. And this is where the cotton pickers collected to get picked up in the morning to go to work, and this is where they got left off and paid at night. And that smoke was bellowing out of those smokestacks. So the tradition of the cotton picker in the meat market was one in which the cotton pickers were, I don't know which end of the bargain they got. Certainly they were hungry for barbecue, but it's also important to remember that the situation that the cotton pickers was in 1891, for instance, was not a great situation. There was a group of cotton pickers that organized the Colored Alliance in 1891, which was a black group that attempted to call a strike to get higher wages for picking cotton. They were paid 50 cents a hundredweight, and they were going to pick it. They were going to strike for a dollar per hundredweight. But the strike was pretty well put down in Texas. In one community in Arkansas, the black cotton pickers did actually try and strike. They were overrun, and in the process, 15 were killed. So after that period, as Neil Foley described in his great book, The White Scourge, blacks were largely replaced by Mexican itinerant farm workers because The Mexicans were more docile because they were recruited to be there to pick cotton if they didn't want to, you know, if they knew what the deal was coming up. And, you know, the Mexicans became the new slaves, as it were. But they also continued the, you know, the love for barbecue. So, you know, in answering sort of John Thorne's questions, I guess what's happened is I've sort of found myself in this process. I mean, I started out thinking I knew what the history of Texas barbecue was. It was these meat markets. And then I discovered, well, you know what? There was actually a much bigger story to that. So I tried to tell that bigger story, which sucked me into yet a bigger story. So, you know, I'm here basically to tell you that I used to think I knew I had the answers to this subject, but the more I look into it, the less I know about it. But to answer the question of, you know, is this simply a case of exploitation and racism? I think it's sort of there's a large body of extenuating evidence. So let's say guilty with an explanation. What happened in Texas after the Civil War is a pretty interesting process of history being rewritten. As Neil Foley says in the book, The White Scourge, as the cotton culture of the South advanced westward, Texas retained the image of a state more Western than Southern, in part because, as one Texas historian, Robert A. Calvert, has noted, cotton makes Texas seem too Southern, hence Confederate, defeated, poor, and prosaic. In Texas, unlike the Deep South, wrote anthropologist Oscar Lewis, there was no leisure class to romanticize cotton farming, and it could at no time compete with ranching in capturing the imagination of the people as an ideal way of life. Tourists flock to San Antonio more than any other Texas city because it alone captures the image the Texans most like to project of themselves. Defenders of the Alamo, victors in the war against Mexico, pioneers in the Western wilderness, manly cowboys, and rich cattle barons. But while longhorns, Stetson hats, and the romance of ranching have replaced cotton, mules, and overalls in the historical imagination of Anglo-Texans today, the fact remains that most Anglo-Texans were descended from transplanted Southerners and fought hard to maintain the color line in Texas. We had a debate, as those of you who came to Austin may remember, about is Texas part of the South? And it's a very curious subject, because at one time Texas was very much part of the South. In fact, the earliest maps of Texas show at the time of the Mexican War, Texas really only extended from Houston, the undisputed area of Texas, extended from Houston to San Antonio, north to Dallas, and over to the Red River. Everything west was disputed with Mexico, was decided as a part of the war, and everything south of the Nueces River was also a disputed territory. So at the time of the Civil War, Texas was very much Southern. The cotton culture was very much the dominant economic activity of Texas, and the culture was, the cotton culture, it was indistinguishable from most of the rest of the South, except that it was very recent. Texas only became a slave state with the Missouri Compromise in 1850, June 19th, 1865 was emancipation, so that's only 15 years of slavery. And as Oscar Lewis said, not enough time for, you know, a great accumulation of wealth and a leisure class and, you know, and the sort of institutions that grew up in the rest of the South. So it was all pretty easily displaced. And that's exactly what happened after the Civil War. People came back, their cotton plantations had been confiscated, Reconstruction had a different ownership of land. But there were millions of longhorn cattle roaming around in South Texas. Those longhorn cattle, in Robert Caro's biography of Lyndon Johnson, he explained how Johnson's forefathers rounded up cattle which were worth maybe $1, $2 in Texas, drove them to Kansas where they were worth $40 a piece. If you could get 1,000 cattle from Texas to Kansas, you made $40,000. So the cattle culture quickly became took over everyone's imagination. And, you know, as Neil Foley points out in his book, it was the South had lost the war, and the South was not very romantic anymore. And we had these cowboys running around. So although the cowboy period really didn't last much longer than the cotton culture, it was only some 30 years that the range was unfenced in Texas and that, you know, our romantic notion of what cowboys are actually lasted, this became the dominant image. And our Southern history, I mean, it's amazing how completely it was erased. All of a sudden, people just didn't seem to remember what had happened. I'd like to read a selection from the book America Eats, which was an unpublished book that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. The story of America Eats, for those of you who haven't heard of it, the WPA Writers Project sent writers out to do oral histories around the country, and there were some 90 oral histories in the South, fascinating reading. But they also asked the writers if there was some marketable product that they thought they might be able to generate. And one of the ideas that came from the Writers Project nationally was a book called America Eats, which would be a description of food folkways across the country. The book was never published. It exists in the Library of Congress. You can go request it and read it. But each state's chapters are still around. The Texas chapter includes a long piece on barbecue. Most of the beginning of the piece is about, in typical Texas fashion, a brag for the largest barbecue ever held, where some numbers are thrown around, 30,000 being one of the largest barbecues held at the time. Let me start. Notable examples have been the Texas Confederate reunions of 1883 and 1884, at each of which an estimate of 20,000 or more were fed. Convention of the Elks in Dallas in 1908, where the figure was 30,000. A feast open at an amusement park in the Palo Duro Canyon in 1924 was attended by 15,000. Neighborhood party by the merchants of Luling, Texas, to celebrate the opening of a new bridge and highway in 1933, each of which had guests numbered at 12,000. Not to mention the granddaddy of them all, the barbecue in Oklahoma City to celebrate the inauguration of Governor Jack Walton in 1923, where 50,000 was the lowest estimate of a crowd. There's a long description of how these giant barbecues were held. Essentially, they dug trenches, stretched some kind of framework across them, mainly beef in Texas, you know, a huge number of cattle, pretty much like the photo I just showed you. But the really interesting part of this barbecue article to me was the history as remembered. Now let's remember that the people writing this is written by a committee of WPA writers, 1930s. These are, I mean, if you think of, you know, of James Agee, Walker Evans, you know, I mean, these tend to be, and most of the oral histories, these people really went out of their way to record the stories of poor blacks, Hispanics. These were egalitarian people of their day. These were not, you know, these were not stony-eyed conservatives who were doing this. But the idea that barbecue had some origins in African American tradition, or that was even practiced in the rest of the South, seems to have completely escaped these people. Here, let me read a little bit. Serious faced but twinkling eyed old cattleman will bravely repeat without credit Charles Lamb's story of the Chinese discovery of roast pig as the authentic historical origin of the barbecue, which in the sense that whatever human experience first produced the idea of cooking meat was the earliest progenitor of grilling it in a pit, it well might be. But precisely when and where a barbecue was first served, in anything like its present form, falls within the realm of folklore. Californians believe it came with early Spaniards to their area. In New Mexico are traditions of similar feasts following the arrival of at Santa Fe of dust-covered wagon trains that had crawled up the trail from Mexico. Texans concede that some simple form of barbecuing meat doubtless came from below the Rio Grande, or perhaps from French Louisiana, but believe that its present form is a Texas development. Even the origin of the name is in dispute. Encyclopedias say that among the Indians of Guyana, a barbacot was a framework of posts upon which meat or fish was cooked or dried over a fire, and that in Haiti a similar framework was called a barbacoa, which word was adopted by the Spaniards in Mexico and later applied to a gridiron for the roasting of whole animals. But authorities do not agree that barbacoa necessarily gave a name to the feast itself. A variant theory is that this derives from the French barbecue, from snout to tail. The International Encyclopedia declares that barbecue was in use in Virginia before 1700, and those who wrote the word may have been setting down the French phrase as it sounded. The best of diarists were none too sure about their English spelling in the early days of the American colonies. Wherever it came from, and whatever in the beginning may have been its recipes and customs, barbecue fell into friendly hands when it met the Anglo-American pioneers who were settling in the Southwest. Let me read that one more time. Wherever it came from, and whatever in the beginning may have been its recipes and customs, barbecue fell into friendly hands when it met the Anglo-American pioneers who were settling in the Southwest. So, if that was a really earnest account of barbecue history in Texas by the WPA writers in the 1930s, it's easy to see where the tradition has gone and why, you know, the contributions of the African Americans, who clearly from the slave narratives and from the earlier information actually brought barbecue to Texas, the same as they had to much of the South. I find myself these days sort of following in the tracks of some enlightened new historians like Neil Foley and T.H. Fehrenbach, who are revisiting Texas history and who are retelling the story from a more enlightened, a more multicultural, a more modern point of view. And as a food historian, I find that food history is basically following along behind these groundbreaking historians. And we're finding that we have to, in light of the new histories being written, new histories of the South, new histories of Texas, we have to re-examine what we've looked at and what we've quoted in the past in all those old cookbooks that claims to be the history of our food. Because just as the history of the culture itself is being rewritten, so must we reconsider the history of the food. In July of this year, the New York Times did a piece on the four, it was Stalking Four-Star Barbecue in the Lone Star State. Oh, thanks. Stephen Reichlin wrote the piece, and the four places described are all white-owned barbecue places. Jane and Michael Stern came down in November, did a piece for Gourmet magazine in which they named their eight favorites, seven of which were white-owned places. I called Stephen Reichlin up before I came down here. I said, "Stephen, when you were in Texas, did you go eat at any African-American places?" And he said, "Yeah, I did." He said, "In my next book, which is going to be a collection of regional barbecue, I'm going to talk about some great Texas African-American places, and it's an omission that I've noticed." I said, "Well, how does it happen? You know, why? I mean, we're getting a reputation for being racist in our approach to barbecue in Texas, but it's national food writers who come down here and, you know, come away with stories of nothing but, you know, white-owned places. So what do we do?" And he said, "Well, Rob, you have to understand, it's like you go to the Uffizi in Florence and you go see Michelangelo's David, you know. These Texas meat markets are, you know. Oh, do I got the wrong museum? Well, I'll have to take that up with Reichland. At any rate, what's in the Uffizi? Isn't it, is Michelangelo in the Uffizi? Oh, all right. Well, so much for that analogy, huh? You go to Florence, okay, there, thanks. You go to Florence, you go see the Michelangelos, and that's essentially what Stephen Reichland was saying, that these places have become so famous, you can't go to Texas and not write about them. But he says, so, you know, it's in the analogy, he said, you know, you've got some great Sicilian painter who's down in the basement, and, you know, how do you wedge him into the story? So, anyways, I think that's our challenge. That's a challenge for the people in this room as we consider, you know, rewriting our Southern food history is how do we rewrite it in the same spirit of, you know, these wonderful new historians who are rewriting our history at large. Thank you.
Say the same thing. Say that's not barbecue, that's smoked meat. And, you know, I mean, that asks me to define what barbecue is. And that's a definition I am not going to venture. We call it barbecue in Texas. And in fact, when you go eat it, as many of you have on our barbecue tour, I don't care what you call it, it's damn good. It doesn't have sauce. And they don't believe it should have sauce, but, you know, as we heard this morning, you know, sauce on the side is probably the smart thing to do because you really appreciate the way the meat is smoked when you have your sauce on the side. So, you know, it's not a large step to forget to eat the sauce. Now,
do you think by any chance that the sauce is going to be away, like from Texas back, because
well, you know, we just heard from our North Carolina source that, you know, Germans came down the Appalachians and brought, you know, some German traditions into Southern barbecue as well. So maybe it, you know, maybe it's one of those crossovers.
Like that.
Could well be.
We have time for one more question, and then we'll take a very short break, and Marcy Cohen Ferris will be up with what I promise will be one of the best talks of the day. Present company, accept. So what are the great black barbecues in Texas? What's the question?
The great black barbecues in Texas. Well, I've got this book here. It has a whole chapter. you know, I've got my favorites. It's like any other subject. There's Ruthie's and Navasota's. There's a favorite of mine. I'll tell you the truth. A longshoreman in Houston was bugging me. He said, you got to go to this place, Thelma. This woman, Thelma, all she's ever done is church dinners, but she's open restaurant. She's only been open for about a year. You got to try it. It's like, oh, yeah, okay, whatever. So I go over to Thelma's. I get some brisket. It's some of the best brisket I've ever eaten. And I come to find out this woman has found a pool hall, which she bought. But this pool hall used to be a barbecue joint a long time ago and has a grandfathered pit with an outdoor, you know, the smoker outdoor, I mean, the firebox outdoors and the smoker indoor. She's putting her brisket on overnight, and she really knows what she's doing. I took Jeff Steingarten there, and he just absolutely melted because he said, you know, I've been
judging brisket, you know, in Memphis for, I've had maybe 50 or 60 of them, I never have figured out what in the world people were raving about, because it just tastes like dry beef to me. But this stuff just slayed them. And, you know, here's a place, I mean, it's a place that's been open a couple of years that nobody's ever heard of. And, you know, I think the truth is, in the black barbecue community in East Texas, you can find barbecue that'll blow your mind at a church picnic. New Zion Missionary Baptist Church is one that's received a lot of press. It's a Baptist church where they started doing a fundraising dinner on weekday nights, and they made so much money they just decided to have it open all the time, so now the church hall is a barbecue restaurant.
When you mentioned the two restaurants that you're famous in, Ruthie's and...
Ruthie's in Navasota, Thelma's is a little place in Houston, Mount New Zion Missionary Baptist is in Huntsville.
What's about Ruthie's and the Thelma's, really? And the point was, are women doing it, as it were, in Texas?
Black women, much more.
Okay. Yeah.
Black, and it is a black, it is African American barbecue, there's a much more women cooking.
Would y'all repeat the question, Rob? Because some of the people on the back were left out of this dialogue.
The question was, I was naming women's names, Thelma's and Ruthie's. So the question was, are these black Texas barbecue places run by women? And the answer is, to a large degree, yes. See a lot more women working in barbecue in black barbecue joints than in white barbecue joints.
And in Texas, then, and elsewhere, it was.
I can speak for Texas.
Well, I certainly don't see that in North Carolina. What accounts for that in Texas?
We'll have to go wrestle those women down and now.